Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
John Feinstein joins us now. Joins us each and every Monday as we react to the big headlines from the weekend. John, how are you?
I'm fine, Jonathan. Chad, I guess Paul's probably taking the long way so he doesn't get back till I'm off, right?
Yeah, he's probably stopping to get lunch right now, just kind of hanging out like he normally does.
Grab some lunch for us, Paul, if you don't mind.
Yes, if Paul's listening right now.
Yeah, me too, Paul.
So, John, I can guess probably what your reaction to this is going to be, but for someone like you and like a lot of people, you don't pay a lot of attention to UFC. When you hear and see the story about a riot breaking out with a fighter who won the fight going into the stands to fight a coach, does that make you more or less interested in the UFC?
Exactly the same.
Zero interest either way?
Zero interest either way. I'm sorry. I've just never gotten into it. I had a good friend, a guy I swim with years ago before UFC got popular, who told me, you know, you got to check this out. It's different. It's unique. And I did, and it was different, but it just didn't excite me very much. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when boxing was a big deal. I was a huge Muhammad Ali fan as a kid. Covered some boxing in my early years at the Post because Sugar Ray Leonard was like a Washington, D.C. franchise. Back then, D.C. didn't have a baseball team, but it had Sugar Ray Leonard. But I've just never been able to get into the whole UFC thing with the kicking, and I just not my thing.
Yankees Red Sox game 3 tonight.
That's my thing.
Yes, I'm moving right on to your thing. Yeah. Series tied at 1. Are the Red Sox in trouble in this thing?
They could be. They could be, and to be honest, I'm a little surprised because I watch a lot of baseball, as you know, and they were really, really good during the regular season. The 108 wins weren't a fluke by any means. I was a little surprised to see Rick Porcello coming out of the bullpen in Game 1. David Price imploded again, as he has so often as a starting pitcher in postseason, and as he has against the Yankees, and you know, put them behind the eight ball right away in Game 2. Now they've got a split in Yankee Stadium, which for a team this good should not be that difficult, should certainly not be impossible. But the Yankees have a lot of power in their lineup. The pitching might tilt in there to their advantage somewhat, especially in the bullpens. If it goes back to Fenway for Game 5, if the Red Sox do get a split, they'd certainly be favored to win a Game 5. And I think, you know, especially if they can hold Chris Sale back for Game 5 and don't have to pitch him tomorrow. But the Yankees, the Red Sox could be in trouble, yeah, and especially in a five-game series, because there really isn't much margin for error. I think the Yankees maybe caught a break playing the Red Sox in the division series rather than the LCS, because I think in a shorter series they have a better chance.
John, I want to ask you about overmanaging in the playoffs with a specific example from last night's Braves-Dodgers game. Brian Snitker, the Braves manager, goes away from Kevin Gausman to start Sean Newcomb because he feels like that he gives him the best chance to beat the Dodgers, a team he almost no-hit about a month ago.
Right.
The same guy who made that decision decides to pull Sean Newcomb for Kevin Gausman in the third inning, even though the Braves are leading 5-0 at that point. Kevin Gausman promptly gives up 4 runs over 2 innings to get the Dodgers back into it. I'm baffled at that decision, and I'm baffled when I watch these games at how these managers at times will overthink everything.
Well, especially, you're right, Chad, with the pitching. I mean, it's become almost a thing where, I mean, the Dodgers being the exception in games 1 and 2 in L.A., where Ryu went 7 innings and Kershaw went 8, but it doesn't seem like anybody goes past 5, if that far, even if they're pitching well. The Yankees took Ishikawa out, I'm blocking.
Walker Buehler, Tanaka. Sorry, the Yankees, you said, yeah.
Yeah, their starting pitcher out with the lead in game two after he'd thrown 78 pitches and given up one run. And, you know, now the people who want to defend Brian Snitker, who I think has done a great job with a young team, will say it's an elimination game. You can't afford to take any chances. Maybe he wants to be able to bring Newcomb back for a game four and got him out early as a result. But I agree with you. I think that was overmanaging. You got a 5-0 lead. You ride the guy at least until he shows some signs that that he's in serious trouble. And now he spent both those guys last night. So if he has to get into his bullpen early this afternoon, he's going to be in trouble.
John Feinstein is with us.
Tanaka, that's who I was thinking of. Forgive me.
Paul is back with us, John. He actually sped back.
Paul, what'd you get me to eat?
I can get anybody anything to eat. That's 2 o'clock, there's going to be some damage done.
I'm starving.
Me too.
John, you know why I'm starving? Because I went out to the bank and got there and realized it was a holiday.
Yeah, now you're carrying around those huge checks in your pocket.
Huge
weighed
checks.
Down.
Chris Columbus. Ruined it for everyone.
I'd go to the post office. The post office is closed. I just couldn't swim this morning because my pool was full. My swim was closed. I'm having a tough day here.
And I had a 4:30 wake-up call in Buffalo. I'd trade with you.
I can relate to that.
John, tonight Drew Brees is likely to become the NFL's all-time leader in passing yardage, passing Peyton Manning. What do you think of when you think of Drew Brees' career compared to the other quarterbacks that we always discuss?
Well, I mean, it's hard to compare. I mean, obviously, all those guys you talk about, whether it's Peyton Manning or Tom Brady or Drew Brees or Aaron Rodgers or Brett Favre, all Hall of Famers. I mean, Brees will go in the Hall of Fame about 5 seconds after he first appears on the ballot. But when I think of Brees, more than any of the other guys, it's overcoming adversity. Passed over in the first round coming out of Purdue because of his height. Because we all know, ask Russell Wilson, ask Baker Mayfield, ask Drew Brees, that you've got to be 6'5" to play quarterback in the NFL, according to most of the scouts. Then, you know, getting injured, hurting his shoulder, which, of course, for a quarterback is a career-threatening injury. The Chargers offer him a contract with basically no money up front, you know, so it was all an incentive. So he says, the heck with you. He goes to New Orleans and was a part not only of the revival of the football team on the field leading to that Super Bowl win, but a revival of the entire city. I mean, he was very much involved both emotionally and tangibly in dealing with the aftermath of Katrina, became a very important figure in New Orleans rebuilding. And so to me, when I think of him, I think of a guy who's overcome a lot. I think of a guy who was still getting it done at 39. And I think of a guy who maybe is a better person than he is a quarterback. And that's saying a lot given how good a quarterback he is.
John, the Red River Shootout lived up to its name this past weekend. 48-45, Texas wins. Huge win for Texas. And Oklahoma fires their defensive coordinator after the game, Mike Stoops. What do you make of that game and what that says about Texas and what that says about Lincoln Riley with the decisive move after that game as well?
Well, I'm not sure what to say about Texas, because what do you say about a team that beats Oklahoma and loses to Maryland? I mean, the only team that has more stunning resume, more difficult to understand resume in the country might be Old Dominion, who lost to Liberty 52-10. Who hasn't beaten anybody except they beat Virginia Tech and fairly handily. So that's sort of what makes college football fun, is those sorts of outcomes. I know from reading online that Oklahoma fans will love this move by Lincoln Riley because the defense has struggled the last couple of years, and it certainly would have been a lot more awkward if Bob Stoops was still coaching. I have never liked the idea of coordinators being made the fall guy, when a team isn't performing. Now you can say they're performing on the offensive side of the ball. They certainly are. And they did give up 48 points, but I don't know. Lincoln Riley, I always say when a head coach fires a coordinator in midseason, weren't you the guy who hired him? Well, in this case, the answer is no. Bob Stoops hired his brother, but Lincoln Riley kept him on when Bob Stoops retired. I'm always uncomfortable with mid-season firings of coordinators. It works out sometimes. I mean, I remember back in 2012 when the Ravens, who never hit the panic button, fired Cam Cameron in December, and then, you know, made Jim Caldwell the coordinator and went on and won the Super Bowl. So sometimes stuff's going on behind closed doors that we don't know about, that maybe it is the right move, but I don't know enough about what's going on behind closed doors at Oklahoma, to say that. But the statistics say that the defense has been the problem, but not just this year, but the last couple.
Midday 180 served up by Wendy's. John Feinstein with us.
Alabama is just ridiculously good, and I know plenty of Alabama people love it, but I'm at the point where...
I don't know, Paul, if you listen to Nick Saban, they're terrible.
Yeah right.
Defense is terrible. They're not playing particularly well at times. Their students aren't showing up. The media is not following Nick's orders. It's clearly a catastrophe down there.
Is it a little bit like the UConn women, where you're so far better than everybody you're going to play, at least until the playoffs, that it becomes not great for the game?
Well, no. I mean, the thing with the UConn women is they just beat everybody by 40. Now, I know Alabama's dominating teams this year, but just go back to last year when they lost to Auburn and had to go to overtime and rally to win the national championship game. So they're not dominating at the level that the UConn women had dominated at for many years. I mean, remember, they had a 90-game winning streak, and then they had a 110-game winning streak, I think, at different points. And I think Gino Auriemma, who's not a funny guy, one of his few great lines was after their 90-game winning streak was broken by Stanford, he said, you know, this losing stuff gets old in a hurry. But to your point though, Paul, it does get, even for Alabama fans, I would think a little monotonous when you're up by four touchdowns every week at halftime. You want your team to win. You don't want to sweat out close games. I know that for most fans, but on the other hand, you do want to walk away from at least a couple of wins a year thinking, oh my goodness, that was a great win. And Alabama doesn't get to do that much of that right now. And all credit to Nick Saban and his staff and his players for that.
Outside of Georgia, who's clearly got it rolling and had a chance to beat Alabama a year ago for the national title,
yep.
Shouldn't everyone else in the SEC be embarrassed right now to look up and see the difference between those two teams and every other program in the conference?
Well, I would think Auburn, in spite of their terrible loss this past weekend, can look back and say, hey, we did beat them last year. And they have beaten them a couple of times in recent years. It's not like Alabama's beaten them, say, 14 in a row the way Navy beat Army there during one stretch. But I would think, yeah, the problem is, if it's a little bit like when Mike Krzyzewski first got to Duke, and his goal was to win the national championship, but he had to get through the team 10 miles down the road if he was going to do that. Gary Williams said the same thing when he got to Maryland. Win a national championship, nice, but got to win my conference first with Duke and Carolina in it. In SEC football, okay, I think all those programs aspire to make the college football playoff and play for the national championship, but they got to get through Alabama and Georgia right now to do it. We'll see if Georgia can maintain. Alabama has maintained now ever really since Saban's second year. But if Georgia can do that, great. But we have to see if other teams can come along and do it, because in the past, as we know, they have.
What did you think of Jason Garrett's decision to punt in overtime last night? What did you think of Jerry Jones' criticism of the decision after the game?
Well, I disagreed with Garrett's decision to punt when he's in Houston territory, fourth and one. You've got to say to your offensive line, fellas, you got Ezekiel Elliott behind you. You got to be able to pick up a yard. But I did understand that they didn't get a third and two earlier, and he was a little nervous about that, and he wanted to play a little bit of field position maybe. Obviously, it didn't work out. I just hate it when owners second-guess coaches. And Jerry Jones does it all the time. He's a general manager, so he feels he has the right to do it. But it's so easy to second guess. Remember 2 weeks ago when Frank Reich went for it on fourth and four I think the 48-yard line, his own 48-yard line. He got crushed for taking the gamble and for putting his faith in his offense. So it's kind of a no-win situation for a coach unless you win the game. You know, if they punt him deep and then the Texans go three and out starting from the 10-yard line and then the Cowboys get it back and just need a field goal to win and get in field goal position and win, Jason Garrett's a genius. But that's the thing. He gets paid $6 million a year to make the right decisions, and that decision turned out to be wrong. Watching it at the time, I actually stayed up for that game for some reason.
Wow.
At the time, I always think coaches should go on fourth and one. I mean, I really do. Because I really think if you're any good, you should be able to pick it up. And the best coaches, Bill Belichick always goes for it, fourth and one. Parcells used to always go for it, fourth and one. Look at what Doug Peterson did last year, gambling on fourth downs repeatedly, especially in the Super Bowl. I think it's almost all it's a gamble because nothing is for sure. But I think it's a good gamble. I think the odds are in your favor.
Especially on the other side of midfield.
Especially on the other side of the field, Paul. Exactly. I agree with you.
John, what have you heard that happened between Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson? Because this morning, Jim Furyk confirmed that something did happen.
Yeah. What I have heard, and again, I was on the other side of the ocean, is that they were all drinking. Obviously, nobody was on the American side was in a particularly good mood for good reason. And Koepka and Johnson, as you know, are very close friends. And something happened involving Paulina Gretzky and Koepka's girlfriend. I don't think she's his fiance. And something was said. I was told again, a secondhand, that it started with something Paulina said. Koepka got upset. And Dustin kind of stepped in. I mean, it's not like Koepka was going to go after Paulina, but Dustin stepped in and said, you know, don't talk to Paulina that way or something along that line. And they had to be separated. There were never any punches thrown, which is why Brooks was able to say without being a liar, this story about us having a fight is made up because technically it was. But apparently, as Jim confirmed, tempers flared. They were all in a bad mood. They were all drinking, and it got heated there for a couple minutes.
That was great info.
I'm thinking secondhand here.
Right.
You combine a bad mood and drinking, and bad things happen quite often.
Yes, it does, especially two big guys, and especially when your spouses are involved.
And while we're at it, Patrick Reed knew of his potential playing partners, right?
Of course he did. Of course he did. I know Patrick Reed pretty well. And he enjoyed playing with Jordan. They were a good team together. Those matches, plus the match with Rory McIlroy, the singles match, made Patrick Reed into Captain America. And I think that his feelings were hurt because Jordan clearly preferred playing with Justin Thomas, who's his buddy, to playing with Patrick Reed. They are not buddies. You remember early in the year, there was a situation where Reed was asking for a ruling. It was on a Sunday. I don't remember which tournament, but it might have been Hartford. He was asking for a ruling, and the rules official said, no, you're not entitled to a drop here. And Patrick said, picked up clearly by the TV mics, yeah, if I was Jordan Spieth, I'd get this drop, wouldn't I? And there's a little bit of a, you know, he's the golden boy jealousy there. And so when Jordan obviously told Jim Furyk, given a choice, I'd rather play with Justin, Patrick Reed's feelings were hurt. But on the other hand, I completely understand what Jim was doing because I'm sure he thought that Patrick, with his, you know, emotions always on his sleeve, might give Tiger Woods an emotional boost. Didn't work out, clearly. Didn't come close to working out. But I understand what Jim was thinking.
John Feinstein joins us each Monday. John, always a joy. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. I'll talk to you next week.
Yep. John Feinstein, each Monday with us here on the Midday 180.